Keith Suter is well known to Australians as a commentator on international affairs. He's been an occasional guest here on Sunday night and over recent years has been one of the regular team on the popular Channel 7 Sunrise program. He's also a member of one of the world's most exclusive elites, the Club of Rome, a global think tank which produced that seminal document in the current debate over the future of the planet, The Limits to Growth. What is less well known is that for over 30 years, Keith Suter has been a member of the staff of Sydney's Wesley Mission, and his term embraces the history of the mission back to the great Sir Alan Walker and includes also the history of the Uniting Church in Australia since its foundation in 1977. Well, with a resume like that, we need to ask, who is Keith Suter? Keith, welcome to Sunday Night.
Thank you.
Now, Keith, I know that's sort of summarising things sort of very tightly, and in this interview we'll unpack a few of those elements. But let me first ask you, what's for you is this connection that keeps you anchored to the church, but also involved on global issues?
Well, I think to use the slogan from Wesley Mission, it's a matter of word and deed. That I am a Christian. I've been a Christian since my late teens. But there is more to being a Christian than just being in a church on a Sunday. There's no long service leave for being a Christian. And you've got to be engaged as an outworking of your faith in activities such as social justice, social welfare, etc.
Many of those involved in global issues analysis these days would say religion's as much part of the problem as it is part of the solution.
I think that's unfair. It is interesting when people say that, because half a century ago, those people were probably saying religion is on the way out. If anything, the religion is bouncing back with a vengeance when you look at many of the issues. And I think that you can say in the history of religion, there have been abuses of power. But I think that we're having to reinvent the way in which the Christian gospel is conveyed to the world. And I also warn people, don't judge the state of Christianity by what you see here in Australia or New Zealand or Great Britain. The church is growing rapidly now in Africa and Asia. Of the 10 largest churches in the world, 7 are in South Korea. So the church is growing rapidly worldwide. It's just that in Australia and New Zealand, Great Britain, Western Europe, the church is certainly in trouble. And I think that what we have to do is to recognise the new areas of growth for the church. Sometimes they run into problems. They clash with their local Islamic neighbours or whatever. I don't think that you can just simply say, if you get rid of religion, you'll get rid of violence. I realise that there are some people who are going around making that argument.
One of a number writing books today.
Absolutely. In fact, I was preaching on that fellow in January of this year at Wesley Mission. My feeling is that the church is growing rapidly, and we in Australia have a challenge. Can I just give you my history of what I think are three waves of the church? The first era of the church, which runs for about 300 years, was the church was a persecuted sect on the edge of the Roman Empire. Then it becomes the established faith of that Roman Empire. Constantine becomes converted. And so we've then had in, say, Australia or New Zealand, Great Britain, this Constantinian era. We're coming to the end of that era. In the Constantinian era, the church ran the institutions. They ran the first orphanages, the aged care centres. Monasteries were built in Europe one day's walk apart from each other. So in other words, the monasteries were hotels. They were the first hotels in the world so that merchants and pilgrims didn't have to sleep in the forests at night. So the churches were involved in a variety of these things.
Building the fabric of Western civilization.
Absolutely. Western civilization comes out of Christian values. Now, what my fear is that we're coming to the end of that era and the church is being increasingly marginalised. And so let me just contrast, say, someone like St. Paul with Martin Luther. Martin Luther, at the time of the Reformation, say 500 years ago, would have difficulty coping with Australia today, because in his day, everybody was a Christian. You're either Catholic or you're a Protestant, but you were a Christian or you were living down the road in Il Baghetto because you were Jewish. However, St. Paul would have no trouble with Australia today. This is the civilization that he knew. So, for example, when he was in Athens, there's this speech that he says, "Men and women of Athens, I see you worship many gods."
The great speech on the Areopagus.
Absolutely. Yes. Now, St. Paul today if he were in Sydney, would say, well, look, I can see you have a variety of gods. You've got McDonald's, you've got football, you've got film stars. Let me tell you about my God. So that's why I think that the church today needs to rediscover what it is to be in a missionary role in an alien society. As I say, St. Paul knew that, and we have become lazy as a result of 1,500 years or 1,400 years when the church was the established institution. It's a new era that's opening up.
You've laid down two directions, both concerned with internationalism in that era. One is your concern with peace and the other with international affairs, and not hard to see how they're linked. Let's, however, before we get into those issues, go back and discover a little bit about yourself. There are traces in your accent of the UK.
Yeah.
Where do you come from?
I come from London. And I went to a school in London, not a private school. I certainly didn't go to Harrow or anything like that. And I was an educational disaster. And so I left school at the age of 15, which you could do in those days. And I then went to work in the War Office. So I went straight in becoming a civil servant. And I take the view that my education began at that point.
The War Office, this would have been the time of sewers and those.
No, not quite that bad. Stop that. That was 1956. No. I went there 8 years later, 1964. Steve Bidoff, in his book on raising boys, talks about the way that boys bond with their mother for the first 5 years and they bond with their father up until about the age of 12 or 13. Then you realise your parents are a dead loss and you then bond with an older person, or should do anyway. In my case, of course, I left school. And I then went to work with elderly civil servants. And, of course, as you can see, the way I'm dressed today, I could easily be a civil servant still in white.
Keith, I'm told you don't own any casual clothes.
I do not own casual clothes. I'm a Methodist workaholic.
Okay, we'll allow you being sort of the true Methodist in spirit as well as behaviour, Keith. Let's go in then to the mentoring situation. Who were your great heroes in that?
Well, they weren't heroes, really, but they were simply people that I worked with. And so, in a sense, I sort of lost a lot of those teenage years because I was working with older people who got me interested in world affairs. They were ex-military people. I've never been a pacifist, by the way. I've always believed there was a right of self-defense. So quite early on, I took an interest in military issues, in world issues. You've got to remember that back in 1964, the War Office, which then became the Ministry of Defense, was still running one of the largest institutions in the Western world. So we had people.
Yes, the British military was still projected well beyond Aden.
Absolutely. It was still east of Suez. You see, that retreat from Suez didn't begin until about 1967. So, retreat from Asia began in 67. So we were heavily engaged around the world. So I developed an interest in military issues, also in international affairs from a very early age. And then also, as a result of becoming a Christian, I joined the William Temple Association, which is the association for lay people associated with the Anglican Church in England.
How did you become associated, linked to the church? I mean, was that through your family?
Well, of course, if you're an Anglican in England, automatically you're an Anglican, you know, because it's an established church, you know, you have to opt out of the Anglican Church. When you're filling in government forms, you've got to say you're a Catholic or a Jew or a Muslim. Otherwise, they'll automatically put you down as an Anglican. So my background would be that of the Anglican Church, but not terribly enthusiastic churchgoers. I wouldn't want you to think that I'm some sort of Bible-bashing individual from that period. It's just, if you're in England, you realise that the English have a very relaxed attitude towards religion. And so I sort of grew up in that. I was a member of the Covenanters, which is the sort of the version of Boy Scouts for people who don't like spending their time in living in tents.
It's sort of echoes of the Reform tradition, though, in a group like the Covenanters, because has back to the great Scottish Covenant and the fight to preserve the sort of...
Well, most of them are actually Open Brethren. Of course, you know, these distinctions only sort of appear to you later on in life when you become an expert on the different strands of Christian thinking.
The fiery cross, part of your symbolism.
That's right. So there's never been a period when I've been antagonistic towards the church. But I think there would have been periods when I wasn't that enthusiastic about it. But then later on, I just got more and more involved. As I say, I joined the William Temple Association. When I eventually got my act together and went to university at the age of 21, I then started to become an Anglican lay reader. And so did the exams through Church House in Westminster in London. And then when I came out to Australia in 1973 to do a PhD, I inquired of the Anglican authorities here, and they wouldn't recognise the work I'd done to be a lay reader in England. So I then sort of drifted towards the Methodist Church, away from Sydney Anglicanism. The late Reverend Frank Engle drew to my attention, just as I was finishing my doctorate, that the then Central Methodist Mission was looking for a director of administration. So I then went into the Central Methodist Mission as Director of Administration in the days of Sir Alan Walker.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest, Dr. Keith Suter. Keith, you just mentioned there a name that will resonate with Australians, the late Sir Alan Walker. I'd like to talk about Sir Alan and your understandings of him in just a moment. But let's have some music first, and perhaps you were to explain why you've chosen this. It's one of the great lovely pieces of church music that many, many people would choose, but for a variety of different reasons. It's called Simple Gifts. Many people associate it, of course, with another set of words. It's had a number of sets of words associated with it. Aaron Copland used it in Appalachian Spring, the ballet. What for you are its associations?
A number of reasons. One is that I think the sentiments are excellent. And so you mentioned earlier my involvement with the Club of Rome. We triggered the environment debate in 1972. And clearly we need to be living lives that are inwardly rich and outwardly simple. Also, for me, it's a reminder of the universality of music, because I was at a church service at Wesley Mission in 1978 when this was sung as a hymn. And then a few days later, I was in New York for a meeting of the UN, United Nations, and that piece of music was being played at the Methodist Centre. So it showed the universality that I'd travelled 12,000 miles, but they were using the same sort of music.
And of course, the song itself comes out of another tradition, which is the Quaker, or even Shaker tradition of the United States.
That's right, and which is the traditional peace church. I might also say, John, just jog your memory about our association, is that I used this for the days when I was doing documentaries for the ABC religious department, and we used this for a program on church and the environment, and this was the theme music that we used when you and I were working together producing radio documentaries.
It's too long ago, Keith, beyond my memory. Simple Gifts. Simple Gifts. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest, Dr. Keith Suter. Keith, let's talk about Sir Alan Walker. You came to Australia to finish a PhD. What were you doing it on, incidentally?
The first PhD, because I'm now working on my third, but the first was on the international law of guerrilla warfare.
And I... This is a strange thing. Before we get to Sir Alan, you've got to unpack this for us. Here you are. You say you get your first associations in public life with working with the War Office in Britain. Okay, I can understand that as guerrilla warfare, but you've also become a committed Christian in this time. So where does the guerrilla warfare thing relate to your membership in the Christian church?
Well, the person who taught me international law was Colonel Gerald Draper, who was a prosecutor at Nuremberg 20 years earlier. So Nuremberg was the late 1940s. I was at university in the late 60s, early 70s. And Colonel Draper got me interested in the role of law in protecting victims and prisoners of war. So it's what we call the Geneva Conventions.
And guerrilla warfare, of course, changes the paradigm, doesn't
it? Well, it does indeed, because, in fact, in the old days, World War II, which is Colonel Draper's era, you had people, at least on the Western Front, who honoured the Prisoner of War Convention. Whereas nowadays, soldiers actually have a very low risk of being killed in war. It's mainly civilians who get killed. And so they try to update the Geneva Conventions to make them more applicable for this new era of warfare. So I wanted to follow this up. The Colonel Draper had got me interested in this. He, by the way, was the legal advisor to the British Red Cross, and I've been involved with the Australian Red Cross. In fact, recently got a medal for all of my efforts, 30 years of service to Australian Red Cross in a voluntary capacity. And also I wanted to study overseas. I wanted to see more of the world. And in those days, Australian universities had a lot of money. And so I got a scholarship from the British Commonwealth Fellowship Scheme and came out here to do a PhD, just intending to stay for 3 years, from 73 to 76, but in fact found it such a delightful country in which to live that I've now settled down and become an Australian.
You met Sir Alan Walker, and Sir Alan Walker was not only a remarkable public figure and a Methodist evangelist in the great Wesleyan tradition, he was also someone who must have resonated for you with his commitment to peace. Indeed, as a young man, Alan Walker had been one of those who accompanied the delegation with Dr. Evatt to the UN.
To the UN. He was there in 1948. He was probably the last remaining person when he passed away who would have been involved with the creation of the Declaration of Human Rights. In fact, they had a special event for him in 1998, so 50 years on. So
would that have been an attraction for you? Were you aware of that then?
Oh, absolutely, because when the late Frank Engel said, well, look, this job would be ideal for you, Alan is looking for a director of administration, and so I went in, therefore, to what was then the Central Methodist Mission. I was certainly very well aware of what Alan Walker was about. I was aware of the good work being done by the Central Mission at that time. I joined and remained there for 5 years.
How did Alan impress you as a person?
His public figure, he was a brilliant speaker, brilliant preacher.
Cast in the mould of the great sort of Billy Graham mould of evangelist, wasn't
absolutely
he? The big crusader.
And you're preaching to conversion, so you're preaching to secure a commitment. Privately, not the best of people. You know, it's probably wrong to speak too ill of the dead, but you know, Sir Alan was an abrasive character. He had no small talk. You always had to escort him around if he were at a social function. He could speak to an audience of 10,000 people without notes, fluently. But you put him in a small one-to-one situation and he wouldn't know what to do. So you always had to be with him to try to help the conversation to go along when he was talking to a third party. So a person who was very good as a public performer but very nervous as a private individual.
Did he have many close friends?
I don't think so. Obviously the family were very important to him, and Lady Walker, who's also now passed away, was of course a major support for him over the decades, but not a person with a close friends. His network was unbelievable. You know, later on, I worked with him when I became the executive director of National Goals and Directions, and Sir Alan's address book was unbelievable. You know, he could use his name to get in touch with a variety of people right the way across the political spectrum.
But in a sense, he was always on show.
Always on show. He was never relaxed. I'm sure he didn't have casual clothes either, although he did used to go swimming. So he's one step ahead of me. He learned to swim. But he was someone who could certainly, you know, he'd be up by 4 or 5 in the mornings, right the way pretty well through to the end.
What did he do to relax?
I don't think he did. He read books. And of course, he would go swimming.
Was he ever conversational in the sense of grappling with ideas? Would he talk them through?
Oh, absolutely. And he was unbelievably well-read, and he had his own system for taking notes of books, which involved Wynne doing much of the work. He would read it and make notes.
Pre-computers.
Oh, absolutely. And so he would then have an excellent way of what we would now call information retrieval, because he would, through a system of a collection of cards, if he had to preach on, say, the doctrine of grace or something, he would go to a collection of cards under grace, and he could say, well, there's a bit there by Temple, there's a bit there from what the Catholic Church had to say, etc. That was his card system. By our standards, it's a very primitive system of information retrieval, but by his standards, before computers got invented, it was very good, and it helps to explain why the man was so well-read in terms of his sermons and his books. As you know, his books always sold very well, and he had a very good relationship with his British publisher, who gave him worldwide circulation for his books.
And of course, he was one of Australia's first television preachers. What was it? I Challenge the Minister.
I Challenge the Minister, and it's the highest rating religious TV program ever in Australian history because of the proliferation of channels, etc. You'll never again get that same sort of percentage. I might also just say that Alan also was an introduction to me of church politics, because his biggest blows had all been inflicted on him by the Methodist Church. So here's a guy who was a pacifist in World War II, got into trouble over that outside, was banned from South Africa twice for his views on apartheid. But at the end of his time at the mission in 1978, he gave an interview where he set out the three biggest blows that had been inflicted on him, and they'd all been inflicted by the Methodist Church because they thought the fellow was getting too big for his breeches. So one was I Challenged the Minister. They cancelled that. Mission to the Nation, which also was very successful.
Which is his big crusade series.
Yeah, they cancelled that. And there was a third project. Oh, yes, when he came back from working with the person who later became Lord Soper in London just before the war, he had trained to do inner city ministry work, and they sent him out to the coalfields. In each, you know, at all the stages along his life, the old men who ran the Methodist Church really punished him for being too good, too outspoken. So for me, it was a good example of the tall poppy syndrome.
And of course, at that stage, even up until he retired from that position, he was in the centre of public attention because of his attitude to the Vietnam War.
Yep, the Vietnam War and a lot of other wars, and of course, attitude on racism. If you go over to the Maritime Museum, for example, they have a display there on the White Australia policy and multiculturalism, and they needed a spokesperson for an early critic of racism and the White Australia policy after around the time of World War II. It's Alan Walker. It's his publication they've got on show.
That must have been a remarkable period for you in terms of expanding your understanding of the church. Because usually at that time in a young person's career, if they're getting involved in the serious politics of public life and involved in academia, they're pulled away from the church as being a closed community. Where Alan gives you a different perspective and platform altogether.
Absolutely. So he's someone who is willing to be outspoken. He could have opinions. That's why the media liked him. You rang the Methodist Church to get an opinion and they would need to form a committee. Whereas Alan will give you an opinion, and you could ring him at any hour of the day or night and he'll give you that opinion. So he was loved by the media, hated by the rest of the church hierarchy. So he kept himself abreast of world affairs and of national affairs. He found a way of bringing the good news of the gospel in with his statements. He was outspoken. He was articulate. He was a good preacher. And, of course, as you know, the Bulletin magazine referred to him as Mr. Methodism.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. We're talking with Dr. Keith Suter, well-known Australian commentator on international affairs, but also a long-time member of the Uniting Church and servant of Wesley Mission. I'm sure he wouldn't mind being described as that. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. John Cleary with you. My guest, Dr. Keith Suter, well-known to Australians as a commentator on international affairs. We're revealing something of his other life. Keith, let's talk about what took you onto the global stage. You're associated with a group that for some people is equivalent to the Antichrist, the Club of Rome. Now, just tell us, what is the Club of Rome and how you, sort of working, beavering away here at Wesley Mission in Australia, get associated with such a body?
Well, it's an international think tank. It was formed in 1972, formed by two individuals, Aureli Pichai, who is the head of the Fiat motor car company, and Alexander King, who passed away only a few weeks ago. In fact, I've done his obituary for the Guardian newspaper in England. These two people, Alex King was a scientific advisor to the British government and was then just retiring from the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, in Paris. So he was somebody who's coming to the end of his full-time career, who then effectively began a whole new life which would keep him busy for another 30 years. Alex King and Aureli Pichai were both troubled individually and separately by the high rate of economic growth and what they would do to the environment. At that time, the word environment meant preserving chateaux, cleaning rivers, that sort of thing, very much preservation. The word environment, by the way, doesn't appear in the UN Charter of 1945. And so they were saying, no, there's much more to the environment than just preserving historic buildings. There is a concern about exhausting the Earth's resources, which seemed unbelievable at the time. Plus, there's a problem about how much pollution we're putting into the atmosphere. That, of course, is now called the climate change debate. So they commissioned a study done by some young computer experts projecting into the future. If we assume that we continue to use resources in the way that we're doing, population growth, etc., what will happen? The book appeared in January 1972. It's called Limits to Growth. It is the biggest selling environment book in world history. And it triggered the environment debate because it resonated with fears that some people had that, in fact, we were damaging the environment. Now, of course, from a Christian point of view, this is not a Christian organization. It's not a religious organization. But, of course, from a Christian point of view, we are called to be stewards of the earth. So for many Christians, this was an interesting sort of wake-up call that we've got to do something about protecting the environment. The book went on to sell extremely well, partly, as you say, for extreme Christian groups. It was seen as being an Antichrist publication. The reason it got its notoriety, which did wonders for book sales, is that the extreme right said that the market will solve every problem. Don't you worry about the environment, the market will solve it. You also had other Christians who were saying, don't worry about the environment, because as the earth destroys itself, Jesus will return. So don't you stop the earth from being destroyed. We must accelerate that destruction. At the other end of the spectrum, the left-wing organizations said that Karl Marx had claimed that all problems could be solved by technology. So you had both sides criticizing the report. It was fantastic. So it was sold, I think, in a total of 17 languages.
How did you get connected to it all then?
Well, I had known Alex through coming out to Australia on a number of occasions and had met him. Because he'd come to public meetings. I might say Robin Williams, one of our colleagues here at the ABC, was also known to the Club of Rome because he was at the launching of the report when it was done here in Australia in 72, 73. So Alex had come out here on a few occasions and I'd run across him then. And then years later, they decided they needed to have, as I say, it's only a membership of 100. John Stokes, a West Australian business person, also recently passed away. John was one of the original 100, and they were aware of my work, particularly as a publicist, being in the media, etc. And so the invitation came right out of the blue in the early 1990s to get involved. They weren't recruiting me because of my link with Wesley Mission or religious links. I've said it's an organisation that doesn't push religious values at all. Instead, it's an organisation that is there to generate debate, originally about what they called the environment. It's now called the global problematique. In other words, how one issue flows into another. The characteristic of the Club of Rome is, first of all, that it's interdisciplinary. The problem with academics is they get to know more and more about less and less until they know everything about nothing. Now, the Club of Rome, by contrast, is interdisciplinary. It is also international. In other words, it's not just concerned about what goes on in one country. It's concerned about the globe. And then thirdly, it takes a long-term view. The problem with politicians is that they lurch from one election to the next. The Club of Rome is saying, well, what's going to happen in 30 years, 40 years' time?
That's a particularly valuable opportunity at a time when not only governments, but organisations funded and dependent on governments are beginning to be influenced by the needs of an electoral cycle. Mm. So the government's capacity to fund organisations depends on short-term goals more and more. So yeah, that long-term strategic thinking is not available. The Club of Rome, I take it, since 72, has regularly updated and become more sophisticated in their analysis. So to what extent is that playing into the climate debate we're having today Australia?
Absolutely. It's not just Club of Rome. I might just say that as a result of the formation of Club of Rome, so many other think tanks have been created. Now, in fact, I noticed that Mr. Blair is about to retire as a British Prime Minister. He's going to create his own think tank. Bill Clinton has already got his own. So having think tanks, which used to be a new idea in the Club of Rome days, is now done almost by any retiring major politician. So it's more difficult to get the sort of airspace that we could do back in the early 1970s. But the Club of Rome original version of the report warned that we would be running into problems around the year 2040-2050. The third and most recent edition of the report is still talking about 2040. Now, the good news is that we have found additional sources of natural resources, etc., and whole new areas are being opened up. For example, drilling for oil enables you to go deeper now than was hard, one could have imagined, say, 30 years ago. That's the good news. The bad news is the growth of India and China. That was not factored into the original version of the report.
And that's a huge multiplier.
Absolutely. And the average Chinese person obviously has ambitions to live as well as we do in the rest of the world. It's interesting to note, for example, that Queensland has one of the largest footprints, to use the technical term, one of the largest footprints in the world in terms of consumption of resources, etc.
So we're bad environmental stewards per capita.
Per capita, that's the key factor. We slip under the international radar because we're only 20 million people. But on an individual basis, we are a real burden on this planet. And the Chinese are saying, well, in effect, well, look, if the Americans and Australians can live well, why can't we?
Until they fix their individual footprints, don't expect us to.
That's right.
Because our individual footprints are still much, much smaller.
And they are over a billion people. Mm. And so the Club of Rome is still warning about that year, say, around 2040. Now, the difference this time is that we've lost 30 years from that original warning.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Our guest is Dr. Keith Suter, well-known Australian commentator on international and other matters. Keith, let's turn our attention finally away from the global platform and towards a little insight into an anniversary that's happening this year, but quiet anniversary. The Uniting Church is celebrating its 30th year of existence this year in Australia. Now, that was a remarkably optimistic creation to bring three disparate traditions together: the Congregational Church, a long history of independent assemblies, the Methodist Church with its strong central ethos of evangelism and engagement with the world, and the Presbyterians, who were very strong on doctrine, and some doctrines of which were, in classical terms, the opposite end of the Protestant spectrum from the Methodists. The Calvinists versus the Arminians had been a long-fought debate. How has it all panned out over years? You were there right at the start.
Absolutely.
You were there when the first votes were cast.
Absolutely. I was there for the inauguration. Well, not the first votes, but I was there for the inauguration of the Uniting Church, because it was done in the Lyceum building in the afternoon. We had the big town hall rally in the evening. I was there for the afternoon commemoration. I wasn't involved. I didn't do the town hall. I was there, but I didn't have to organise anything. In the afternoon, I was what was grandly called the Lyceum Property Trust steward. And so it was my job to liaise with the police, because there was a Canadian minister called McIntyre who disapproved of churches coming together.
Well, he despised the World Council of Churches in particular. He pursued them around the world, didn't he?
Absolutely.
He followed Philip Potter, wasn't
he? Philip Potter. And so Dr. Potter was there for the ceremony.
Great West Indian figure.
Exactly. A great leader in the church. And so my job was to work with the police to try to restrain these demonstrators. So I got hit over the head
with McIntyre faction.
That's right. And I got hit over the head with a placard. I feel I've been hit over the head every so often in the United Church. So I was there right at the very beginning. There was real enthusiasm. As you know, it had taken quite a long struggle, because it had been about 70 years of negotiations to bring on this union. And, of course, in Great Britain, there had been a failure of an attempted union between the Methodist and the Anglican churches. We'd pulled it off. We'd been able to create this church, which is uniting in the sense that it's open to bringing other people in. But a lot of that enthusiasm has now waned. And
It's strange, isn't it, how that top-down ecumenism, and this applies to bodies like the World Council of Churches too, has sort of fallen into sort of disrepute in a way, yet at the same time, what you're getting is sort of very grassroots ecumenism as the boundaries between denominations, particularly on doctrinal basis, are breaking down and people sort of just go where they're comfortable.
And I think one of the reasons that you don't get those big doctrinal disputes is that people just don't have an interest in doctrine anymore. That increasingly,
and that's look a good at, thing and a bad thing.
A good thing and a bad thing. But let me just say that a lot of the churches that are growing are those that are sort of doctrine light, but entertainment heavy. So lots of music, lots of entertainment. There's real enthusiasm, but there isn't much of a proclamation of the word, as I would have known it, or Sir Alan Walker would do it.
And it takes it out of the public sphere too, doesn't it?
It does.
It takes it very much to a private entertainment.
Very private. So you're not really engaged fully with the world. Now, of course, the tradition at Wesley Mission has always been to have word and deed together. That was also a strength of the Uniting Church. The Uniting Church is the second largest provider of welfare services throughout two-thirds of Australia. So the two-thirds which are outside Sydney, Melbourne, and etc., out there in the bush, the second largest provider of welfare services is the Uniting Church. Number one is the Commonwealth Government. Number two is the Uniting Church. The Uniting Church is big in terms of aged care, childcare, Lifeline, whatever. In fact, Lifeline was started by the Mission and Sir Alan Walker. So the Uniting Church has a long tradition of active work. It doesn't necessarily get the credit in public for all the welfare services that it provides.
At a personal level, are you optimistic or pessimistic about that experiment?
Well, that's what my third doctor is about at this very moment. I'm looking at scenario planning, which is one of the ways I earn a living outside of Wesley Mission. Scenario planning is a management technique for thinking about the future, pioneered in the civilian sector by the Shell Oil Company. And I'm having to develop for my PhD in religious department at Sydney University four scenarios for the future of the Uniting Church, one of which would be the winding up of the Uniting Church, because you've got to think about the unthinkable. But also it could be that we could have a way of a growth of the Uniting Church through word and deed, particularly propelled along by the deed activities, because the governments of the day are downsizing and outsourcing, and the Uniting Church is picking up so many ways of providing those services. Another one may well be a rediscovery of that early church. In other words, that one that's just focusing on house churches, small stuff without being burdened with so much property, etc. And then perhaps another growth would be one that is just very much just focused simply on welfare alone. Spiritual side, you're just there to provide welfare.
What for you are the essentials to keep alive? I mean, if you get rid of all the inessential elements, what for you is the essential thing that must survive if this thing called the church, in its most general sense, is to be of continuing worth to the world?
It has to be word and deed. It has to be Christians being converted, and as an expression of their faith, as an outworking of their faith, doing good within the community. And so in not just keeping it to themselves, but just simply saying, as a result of amazing grace, I am now inspired to work to improve the rest of society, to work towards the kingdom of God.
So ultimately, it's not about church growth.
Not necessarily, because a lot of church growth is just pea and thimble calculations and getting people to attend church. John Wesley said that the whole world is his parish. There was nothing insular about John Wesley. One of the problems I have with a lot of church growth movements is that they think if they get people coming in on a Sunday, they've done their job.
It's defined as congregational growth.
That's right. My view is that you not only get them in on a Sunday, but you get them out there working Monday to Friday or Monday to Saturday as Christians. And you should be able to be so different, so distinctive by your behaviour that people can say that person is a Christian because of the high nature. In other words, they're not on alcohol, they're not on drugs, they're not cheating people, they're not ripping people off, and they're working for a better society.
Keith, it's been great to have you on the program.
Thank you.